Welcome back, everyone. My name is Dr. Lee Piccarello.
Dr. Hunter Stevens.
We are going to engage in chaos, 2021 version, that is. And we are going to hear a lot from Dr. Hunter Stevens regarding Mindfulness 2.0, the very insightful work that we recently did for MIT Sloan and our research and development. And we are going to throw around back and forth this notion of how chaos lives amongst us, how chaos continues to come and envelop all of our lives. And Dr. Hunter Stevens is going to provide some very dynamic solutions through the course of his work and through the course of his contribution here at Mindful Athlete Training. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
The whole crew.
The whole crew is there.
Yeah.
Cobra Kai, Cobra Kai, Cobra Kai. Welcome back to another episode of the Head Game Podcast. My name is Dr. Lee Piccarello.
Dr. Hunter Stevens.
And we are live with you here today, coming out of Newtown, Pennsylvania. Just rocking to a little Cobra Kai in the background, courtesy of Podcast Mike. Thank you so much for that. Episode 56,
chaos. 2021.
2021, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. We've been away for a while.
We've been away for quite a while. We have done some, we've done actually a lot of research.
Yes.
And we can talk about that a little bit later. But we had our typical end of year Mindful Athlete retreat, which was an incredible success.
Yes, it was.
We did a lot of positive work on where we want to be in 2021, 2022, and beyond. And as I'm sure everyone is noticing, hopefully you're noticing, we've made some significant upgrades to the podcast studio.
Looking good. Looking good.
We finally got our new signage up.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, you know, it's bright and bountiful for all to throw their gaze upon. And how are you? How were your holidays?
Good. Holidays were good. I think they were unique in their own right. Typically, we get together on Christmas with about 50 of my wife's family, but this year we spent it with just...
Because your wife's family is pretty big, right?
Yeah, her mom has about 6 brothers and 1 sister. Mm-hmm. So then their family gets together, and now the families have been growing, kids now, but now this is the first time in my 10 years with their family that I haven't spent it with all 50 of them. So it was definitely different, a little bit smaller, but it was still nice. So it was good to kind of have that time together and be with family, because that was limited throughout the year as well.
Yeah. I found the holidays very frustrating this year. And not to be some New Year Debbie Downer, but for obvious reasons, just the limitations. But I think I've talked to a fair amount of my clients about this. For me, there were two things that I think emotionally, psychologically, I was looking forward to, which were symbolic of the end of 2020. The first was the election. And we all know how that panned out. Still, as of this week, panning out. And the holidays.
Right.
In my mind, way back when, in March, when the world went silent, and we all retreated inside and closed our doors, I'm going to put in a request. Can you, Podcast Mike, at some point in this show, bring up Styx, The Best of Times? Because there is a... I'm going to test some of your knowledge.
I have no musical knowledge. Like bands, songs. Like if you ask me to name someone in a band...
There is...
Like Kurt Cobain, I'm barely knowing is Nirvana. Like it's not good. It's not good at all.
There is a... Styx, great band, does a song called The Best of Times. And there, it's like one of like the hardcore like 80s rock ballads. That it would, I'm sure, it would fall into that category. But there is a verse in there that talks about the best of times and the worst of times, and it is eerily suggestive of the year 2020, talking about, you know, locking your doors and hiding inside. And in my mind, when everything hit, I talked about this when we were doing Zoom podcast style conversations during the quarantine. For me, the chaos of 2020 became a test of endurance.
Mm. Yep.
You made your eyes pop up there. I got you on that one.
Well, it's so true because it just was, okay, this is going to be a few weeks. Then it's now a few months. And now it's just kind of
kept. How did you deal with that?
On.
Mindset-wise.
Yeah, I think.
Where'd you go?
I had phases throughout 2021 or 2020 because I made shifts, I guess, in my career from being a full-time student to a full-time employee to a full-time worker. And I think I had that shift, which was nice for me to be able to make those shifts. So mentally, I think it was a little bit more kind of digestible in a way. Typically, our work is our day-to-day work also is an essential work. So I'm not stuck in my house every day compared right. to maybe some other people who have been stuck in their house really for 9.5 months. I can imagine that being even a more significant endurance grind.
Yes.
But it's still weighed on me. The limitations. Hey, I want to go here. I want to go see them. What's that like? What are their kind of opinions? What are their views? How do I make sure that they're safe? You always kind of had multiple aspects always in mind. And I think there's a drain with that.
Yeah. I think there's a big time drain with that. Mm-hmm. For me, it was an opportunity to get back into some type of former identity of athlete mode.
Mm.
I saw it almost as a competition
mm-hmm.
between myself and COVID, myself and the world,
mm-hmm.
that I wasn't going to let the typical parameters that were being established, almost the guidelines of the chaotic game.
Right.
I wasn't having it.
Okay.
And I'm not suggesting that I was out trying to violate every, you know, COVID related rule. Has the statute of limitations expired for that yet? If you violated COVID rules back in March and April, is there a statute of limitations for that? I don't know. Maybe there are. I took it very personally. I think it was the only way that I found to kind of activate my own defense mechanisms to stay strong.
Right.
That's what I felt that I needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there were just things about what we now know officially as COVID fatigue
mm-hmm.
that way back in March, April, May, June did not have a name.
Right.
But it was this phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
It was this chaotic tornado that was present that instantaneously showed up.
Right.
And now chaos because it's all around us. And you know, this is in large part a huge emphasis of who we are at Mindful Athlete Training, but it's even a greater point of, you know, what we've affectionately referred to as our off the clock
right,
conversations.
Right. Yeah. And it all comes down to, I think, disruption. Right. So if we all knew that, you know, it's going to be a grind, but on November 15th, everything is going to open up and get back to normal. I think that would have been much more digestible than, okay, we're going to open back in April. Okay, no, now it's July. No, now it's October.
Right.
Okay, now we're going to open up a little bit. Now we're going to close it all back down.
Right.
Okay, now in December, everything 2021, things going to go back to normal. And I think the uncertainty and the mental scripts of this is my expectation, this is what's going to happen, and then that disorganization, that desynchronization is occurring, it's throwing everybody off rhythm.
Yeah.
Of what I'm used to.
Yeah.
What my daily day looks like, what my interactions look like.
So let's take just a step back for a moment. When you think about, you know, we're in the process of really rebranding.
Yeah.
We're doing major overhauls to our website. We've conducted ourselves more in a research and a development capacity the last 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's been an extension of research that we've been doing throughout the evolution of our lab. But it really came to a head a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Share some of that.
Yeah. So a few months ago, we were, again, continuing to look up how do we continue our research? How do we continue to invest throughout the 2020, and we were finding that the opportunity to work with athletes kind of hand in hand sometimes was limited. There was a limited interaction. We were working with people virtually. We were having some people in the office, but obviously not as many as we normally do just because of the reasons. And what we found was through our research was that there was this MIT Sports Analytics Conference. And this conference was something that we've kind of discussed going to in the past, back in 2018, 2019, mm-hmm. and then earlier in 2020. But we kind of found that they had this research competition. And this research competition was kind of looking at, you know, how are you impacting? What are the analytics that are impacting sports, the business of sport, basketball? I think specifically soccer was the other one, or just other general categories. And through our research, we found that something that we had, we wanted to really solidify and show the world what we have been doing kind of throughout the 2020 year. We like to say, without, you know, what can we do without? And I think that mentality has really kind of rung true for us throughout 2020, which has allowed us to progress so much throughout that year and throughout that challenge. Is what can you do without versus what can you do with, right? Everyone is always looking for, oh, if I had this, if I had that, right? But situations are rarely optimal.
Because things are different, what can we do even in spite of that difference?
Exactly. And so what we found was that this MIT Sloan, the business school at MIT, had a sports analytics conference, and we entered. We wrote an extensive 25-page research paper that looked at all of the elements of mindful athlete training. And what we really found was our identity within that paper. We really solidified through empirical research, through meta-analysis, through regression analysis, that what we do here is one of the most effective ways to really train an athlete, especially in their mental strength, not mental skills, but mental strength.
Help me understand the difference between what you mean between that, between mental strength and mental skills. Because one, I think a lot of people, when they hear mental skills, mm-hmm. think very traditional in one way. And mm-hmm. two, many people don't know what mental strength is.
Right.
Or the difference.
Right. And so when you think about skills, you're thinking about things that you can maybe utilize, tools, right? Abilities. And I think there are a lot of things, especially in the mindful space, that look at, okay, mental skills as, okay, let me go sit down, close my eyes, calm, quiet space, and visualize, right? Meditate. Those are things that you can utilize, right? Nice, calm, and quiet spaces. Mental strength, on the other hand, is think about it as strength and endurance training. You have to put resistance into what you're doing. You have to put challenge within what you're doing. So mental strength is you actually have to put physical strain on your brain to then train it. And by doing that, you're utilizing and leveraging neuroplasticity, which means is your brain is always changing, right? When you woke up this morning and when you go to bed, your brain is actually different. It's always growing. It's forming new connections. It's pruning old things that you don't know. You don't need to know what you ate for lunch 6 months ago. It's not relevant information. It's kind of getting passed through and kind of pruned, as well as your brain getting strengthened by pathways you're using more consistently. So mental strength is training, is the strength training of your brain through various kind of challenges, strategies. Rather than just kind of mental skills and escape, it's more embrace those challenges to kind of push you to be stronger.
I remember a few weeks back, you brought up the analogy of physical training with leg kicks. And you talked about, I don't remember the exact term that you used, mm-hmm. but actually, you know, at a very microscopic level, mm-hmm. breaking aspects of bone mm-hmm. so that they come back
in more of that healed capacity. It's fighters, what they do is they'll fight. We were talking about Cobra Kai, so that's kind of funny. Fighters.
I have karate on the brain. Karate. Right.
Fighters will kick like a post, like a slightly padded post, but it will create microfractures.
Right.
It's the same thing with the hands. And what that does is it calcifies and creates strength within those elements. So that I can get hit harder, I can take more like kind of bruising.
It sounds like that philosophy is analogous to your mental strength model.
It's all about challenge, pressure, and recovery. When you challenge yourself and put pressure, you're putting yourself into a position of vulnerability, of acceptance, of acknowledgement, but it's also straining it. And through then proper recovery, you're able to then build that back up, right? Muscles aren't built because you're working out. Muscles are built through the recovery. You can do the same exercises, but if you don't have proper recovery, you're going to be injured more often, fatigued more. You're not going to see the same gains as somebody else. It's recovery aspect of the strain. But the recovery doesn't have a part without the strain. So you need one and the same. You need both of them together, kind of in a consistent manner. And I think a lot of people neglect the challenge or the strain you put on your brain as the as an important aspect of it. People always are looking for recovery.
Right. So what is it about the lab? Because I know, again, as we've worked on this reestablishment, this clarity of our brand and our identity, mm-hmm. we've put that much more emphasis in the lab, which mm-hmm. kind of goes back to the MIT Sloan research piece. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just in the celebration of today's discussion where there's chaos all around us,
right?
You know, the notion that chaos is coming, mm-hmm. right? We very easily could have said that way back in January, February, to speak to this notion of this coronavirus that's somewhere in the world, mm-hmm. but the essence of it, not if, but when it arriving, like
right.
chaos was coming to town.
Right.
Right. And then it clearly arrived, and then we're still in this recovery process. Talk to me a little bit more about, as you oversee, you know, head of mental skills in the lab, what sort of ideology of chaos does the lab represent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the lab itself, in terms of chaos, is we like to say it's chaos simulated, but we use our systems, calm, focused, engaged, and then we utilize an integration effect model. And chaos is the primary driver for all the things that we do. We integrate it into every single type of training that we do. So we do a similar, that you might be more familiar with, kind of a breath training, a more meditative state, more visualization. But what we love to
more of that escape.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which a lot of people identify with pure recovery.
Right. And there's an element to that. Right? Right. But it's one piece. And we can talk about why one piece versus multi pieces in an integrated system is more effective.
Which is what we established with MIT.
Paper. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But this one element that we utilize is our first element, because it is the foundation for a lot of things. We like to incorporate, right, as you're kind of being calm and serene, the most chaotic thoughts, the most chaotic moments, pressuring you, not in a calm environment, blasting rock and roll music while you're also trying to be maintaining a calm state, standing on a Bosu ball, trying to maintain balance at the same time, listening to crowd noise and vibrating your whole body with a subwoofer backpack. We're doing while you're also trying to meditate and trying to be calm, because life isn't a calm, quiet environment.
Right. It's not a vacuum.
It's about challenge. It's about, I'm going into the city, the craziness of it, my workplace. I expect one thing, something else occurs.
It's not a safe place.
But you can still be mindful. You can still be calm within that space if you've been training in it. It's something that you're now adapting to. It's not something new to you. This is an environment you've been in. Chaos is your friend. You're not looking to escape it. So that's our first stage. Mm-hmm. We then do that with your focus state, right? Again, tend to be when you're training in our focused lab, you're not just looking for, can you just focus on one element of it? It's, can you attune to multiple elements and then shift your focus dynamically?
Right.
Because that's what the demands of life are. That's what the demands of performance are. It's not about focusing on one thing. It's, can you focus on one thing while all of the chaotic things are going around, while also recognizing the things that are going around? And then again, our next station, our engaged station, where we engage our athletes, we train neuromuscular timing. Chaos is, how do I desync them? How do I get them into a rhythm where they feel comfortable and then completely take them out of it?
And just shatter it.
Because that's what we're looking for, because we want our performers who come into our lab to be able to adapt to that. Because the head game of life is really looking at, how do I make those changes, those push and pulls, and really adapt? How do I be flexible and not rigid? And that's chaos. That's embracing chaos. It's not an if, exactly what you said. It's a when. I think the ignorance that this couldn't have happened is something that is on the human race, right? It's easy that viruses take out entire grape fields. Viruses take out tons of animals. We're ignorant to say that wouldn't happen to humans.
Happened to us, exactly.
And I think this occurred, we're weathering it, we're adapting, and hopefully the shift makes us stronger overall, right? It only is failure until you stop trying, right? Once you stop trying, that's failure. So you got to continue to work at it, right? That's embracing the chaos as well.
And when I listen to you talk about that explanation of, you know, the integration model, mm-hmm. and we spoke earlier just a few moments ago about, help me understand the primary emphasis of the research paper, mm-hmm. of the conclusions that we came, you know, you mentioned that we did, you know, a meta-analysis. So mm-hmm. we're going out and we're looking at all the research that's been conducted, mm-hmm. right? And then we did a multiple regression,
right,
as it relates to how those key variables of training in a single type of model versus a host model, mm-hmm. or more than one. Mm-hmm. And what conclusions did we come up with?
Yeah, right. So it was a proposed model for integration training. And what that was looking at is a single approach, something just singular. Am I just doing meditation? Am I just doing yoga? Am I just doing one element of mental skills training? Or am I integrating all the systems? Am I using my breath? Am I using my body? Am I leveraging my neurochemistry? Am I utilizing the fires of my body in terms of neuromuscular timing? And utilizing all those systems as well as my brain waves to be able to focus. And the integration of all of them, we were looking at, is that going to be more effective? And what we found was an integrated training effect as compared to the holistic performance theory, which, just as a recap, holistic performance theory is a theory that looks at performance in a dynamic way by identifying the elements that disrupt your ability to maximize your already raw skills. Raw skills isn't something that anybody can train. It's something that you have innately.
It's what you have.
Yes. And so the elements that then disrupt that.
Should I say what you start with?
Yes. Right. That includes your ability to practice deliberately. It includes your ability to show effort or put out effort, as well as the rate of perceived exertion. So how much you perceive you putting in versus you receiving out, and then ultimately mental fatigue, which we've all recognized over this past year, but that affects everything. Mental fatigue is the number one performance inhibitor. And so we cross compared an integrated training model with a single approach training model to all of those elements. And what we found was overall performance was improved through the meta-analysis, through recognizing different articles, looking at runners, looking at sprinters, looking at swimmers, and I believe dancers. And overall, what we found was performance improved overall as a result of an integrated training versus single model approach, as well as an overall improvement in cognitive endurance. Again, the opposite of a mental fatigue. So cognitive endurance actually rose. So you're able to take on more strain, more challenge. You also perceived yourself as doing better, or you actually had a larger threshold for tolerance of failure as a result of that as well.
So when, again, you know, this science tries to better establish that the integration of physiological systems mm-hmm. not only can lead to optimal performance, mm-hmm. but if you overlook the whole athlete, mm-hmm. the entire performer, then you're really just addressing one piece of the puzzle, correct?
Yes. And when you, and what it does promote too is when you look at the whole integrated effect, because it's looking at the whole model of an individual, you can then branch that out to looking at the whole development of a team, of an organization. And you talked to me a little bit about, and we actually included the Jordan effect.
Yeah.
And what is the Jordan effect for our listeners?
A little blast of the past, back to the 80s. Well, 80s, 90s, and beyond. So the Jordan effect, actually, you know, it's on, I think, is it Wikipedia? Anyway, you can Google it. It's out there. If you Google it, I mean, it must be true. The Jordan effect is, obviously, most people know who Michael Jordan is, arguably the greatest basketball player of all time. We'll save the Jordan LeBron discussion for another day, Dr. Stevens.
Player, scorer, okay.
And 6 NBA titles. And The Last Dance, which was highlighted during
June?
This past summer. Right, yeah. This past summer. ESPN, 10-part, 12-part miniseries? 10. 10-part miniseries. Fabulous. Loved it. Talked about Michael Jordan. And was very reminiscent of the effect that he had on his teammates. So if you could look at him, whether you think he's the greatest of all time or not, he's certainly in the conversation. His presence alone, the value, whether it be statistically, whether it's points per game. A lot of people don't know this about Michael Jordan, but he was identified as the defensive player of the year.
Yep.
And was on several all-defensive teams. So he wasn't just a scorer. He wasn't just a playmaker. Mm-hmm. He was arguably one of the most well-rounded, or mm-hmm. I'll call holistically based, regarding pure athletic performance, athletes of his generation.
Yep.
But what was revealed in The Last Dance, which most people who did not grow up in that era did not know, is that Michael Jordan didn't start winning championships until he started to really trust his teammates.
Right.
And then you look at the Scottie Pippens of the world. You look at Paxson. Mm-hmm. You look at Kerr. You look at Rodman. And you look at the host of other characters that assisted him all along the way. It was only when he got turned inside out by the Detroit Pistons on a host of occasions, which was preventing him from getting to the NBA Finals because they had their number, that he reinvested in himself, his ideology as a basketball player, and how he would start to, for lack of a better term, share the wealth.
Right.
So the Jordan effect is, yes, you are a superstar, but you're so damn good that the sheer presence of that person mm-hmm. makes the other, in this case of basketball, four others mm-hmm. better.
Right.
It makes them rise their game. It makes them want to be more like Mike. Maybe we can bring up a Be Like Mike ad just so I can get a little blast from the past, which was a whole promotional Gatorade series of Be Like Mike. It was a very catchy jingle. And when his teammates wanted to be like Mike, their points per game went up, their assists went up, their steals went up.
Right.
So the Jordan effect was the pure...
They just got better because of him.
Just better because of him.
But then they rose to that, right?
But...
So it pushed them. Dot. It pushed the team to be better, right? And thus...
The team, the organization, the entire culture.
Right. And that's why people invest a lot, right, in a franchise quarterback.
Yeah.
Right. In a superstar. Right. Because it's not just about that individual. It's how they affect the others. Right. And it's the recognition, though, that he could leverage himself, too, to be better by utilizing the team around him.
Yeah. And for sure.
And I think it's that recognition, too, of, again, the whole we talk about, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Right. Right. Each individual
very
person,
Gestaltian of you.
Each individual person is very strong. Right. If you look at Dennis Rodman, if you look at Scottie Pippen, if you look at Michael Jordan, Steve Kerr. Right. Very strong team.
Don't forget about Bill Wellington.
Yeah. Yeah. OK.
He was a big man. Yeah, Come on.
And through that, though, right, the team then grows, right? Through each individual player being strong enables everyone to be strong, right? And mentally strong as well,
yeah.
Right? The resiliency to kind of go out and party in Las Vegas and then come back and play a game.
To have Jordan go out and recruit you and make sure that you get back home again.
Right, exactly. Right.
But to that point, right, when you bring up the Jordan effect and then we kind of quickly shift back to this single model. If the single model of training mm-hmm. is the premise for the Jordan effect, mm-hmm. and we are looking at integration,
right.
Revisit the, you know, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. I think people need to have a better understanding of really what we mean when we say that.
Yeah. So if we can assume that there's a certain level of gain from each element, and what we find is that if there's one element you train, let's say you get a 5% gain, right? That's kind of being generous sometimes. That's kind of sometimes being limited. But let's say you get a 5% gain from training one element. And if you train that one element, you're going to get that 5%. But if you do an integrated model, that same one element that would have had 5% gain, you're going to get a 10% gain.
Right. So help me understand that.
So, yeah. So
what's going on? What's happening that 5 goes to 10?
Yep. So what's happening is the interplay of all systems in harmony together. Mm-hmm. So when you're training one system with the next, it's helping you not only dig deeper within each element, it's helping the incorporation of them, right? If your body is within synchronicity, you're much more likely attuned to be understanding how your body's responding and reacting when you're in a fight-flight response, so you can accurately and utilize a breathing technique.
So just for clarification, when you say the whole body, mm-hmm. I'm thinking heart, mm-hmm. brain, mm-hmm. muscles, mm-hmm. nervous system.
The crown of your head to the soles of your feet.
Okay.
Right? That is everything in synchronicity. Right.
Those key domains mm-hmm. of human performance.
Yeah. Someone I don't know if I admire, but definitely someone that who is a renowned figure is Bruce Lee. Right? And one of, as you drink, he likes to say, be like water.
Be like water.
And they actually did a a series on
what
that.
What would water
do? On ESPN. Well, water is fluid, right? Water is non-rigid, right?
Adaptive.
It's always moving. It's always in flow. It's looking for the path of least resistance, but also can lay you on your back, right? It's strong yet supple. It's everything. And our bodies sometimes and our minds tend to be fairly rigid. And our approach to things tend to be fairly fixed. But what an integrated approach does, because you're looking at all the systems and the integration of all the systems, it's allowing you to understand, be acknowledging and accepting. And what that's allowing you to do is be consistently flexible and flow no matter what comes at you, right? It allows you to embrace that chaos, right? As COVID happens, it's not about, okay, well, I had these plans and now I'm completely on my butt and don't do anything. It's no, now what do I do as a result of this moment?
As a byproduct of that chaotic introduction,
yes.
How do we typically respond? I think that could be the question of 2020.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm going to pull up this article from the Navy SEALs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of talking about that exact moment, right? You can deem that like...
Well, they bathe in chaos.
Well,
right?
War is probably the most chaotic thing you can experience in life, right?
That most of us can only imagine, but, you know...
And these people have to train. They have to be prepared. And what this article is talking about is Navy SEALs love chaos. They are masters of chaos. And that doesn't mean necessarily just them embracing chaos. It's also them bringing chaos to others. I want to disrupt the rhythm, the timing of everyone else who we're battling, who we're fighting, our enemy, right? Cut off food supply. That's chaos for them.
Sure.
Right? Rain fire. That's chaos for them, right?
Right?
It's how do I disrupt them to a point that they just can't organize? They can't put systems in place. And they define chaos when you don't have control of it, or when you're not recognizing it, when you're not embracing it, as a constant headaches and ongoing surprises.
Mm.
Constant headaches and ongoing surprises.
When I hear you say that, I think the disruption of scripts.
Yes.
Right? Our scripts of how we go about life, about how things should be.
Yep.
What is the best way for us to operate? What's the optimal outcome that we want to achieve? What's that script? You know, human beings in general like to prepare.
Right. Yeah. There's a saber-tooth tiger in there. Stop going there. Right. And I think it's helping us make sense of the world and understand this person's on our team, not on our team. It helps protect us. It's our way of making sense of the world, right? Our scripts. But a lot of times our scripts are flawed or filtered. I like to say we have our own filter, right? Social media has its filter. And when you look at social media, you sometimes think that's real, but it's not always, right? You tend to see one thing. Even our minds like to see the world in one way. We tend to see the world through our filter, which is our own filter, right? Our human filter, my hunter filter, your Lee filter.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you see the world. Through your own filter, but it's not very objective and it's very one-sided, and it creates scripts that this is how it has to go. It has to be this way. And when it's not, you completely go off the rails because it's not what you thought it was going to be. The Navy SEALs then say, well, what's organized chaos? What's chaos that we can recognize?
So they actually say that chaos can be organized.
Yeah.
Well, versus unorganized?
Well, it's interesting. Well, it is disorganized chaos, right, is the constant headaches and ongoing surprises and organized chaos. And before I kind of read what organized chaos means, I think it's really interesting because it will talk about more so the resources it takes to take on that chaos rather than the chaos itself. It says organized chaos is constantly having an organizing system. Chaos, constantly having an organized system. And it goes on to talk about how the organizing system is, what resources do I have? What are the elements and development that I can put in place? What are my strategies that I typically have or coping mechanisms? What are my traditional patterns that I would be going about if this is occurring? And how do I disrupt it if it's not going the way that I want? It's understanding the systems that you have in place that continually perpetuate you getting disrupted by chaos. And by you understanding that pattern, you can then start to adapt to it, right? Understanding how you can regulate your body, how you can remain focused, how you can gauge and synchronize all in that time as well.
Yeah. So when you bring up the examples of Chaos and the SEALs, obviously they're an elite group that is engaging in specialized training. Mm-hmm. They're putting themselves in those situations for a very specific purpose. Mm-hmm. Again, let's take a step back in what we're trying to accomplish in 2021.
Yes.
Through mindful athlete training and our performance lab and the integration effect that we're trying to establish with performers across a myriad of domains, mm-hmm. not necessarily just the athlete. Yes, it is mindful athlete training, but we've also said that, you know, there's an athlete in all of us, mm-hmm. that performer that is looking to engage in a higher learning curve. We firmly believe that chaos is now the integral piece, mm-hmm. that not if, but when it is introduced, and then we kind of jack up the volume.
Right.
What is it that we can actually do with those performers once they get to us that separates us from everyone else?
Right. Well, we can collect, we can put them through that chaos, right? We can introduce it. But we can now record, right, through biosensor technology, like the data that comes with it, right? Mm-hmm. How your physiology, how your mind is actually responding as a result of that chaos being put on you.
Right.
And why that's important is we can help you understand under duress, under challenge, how are you naturally responding? What are those patterns that you typically do? What resources do you have, right? Through our BioQ assessment, you can understand like what strengths, what areas for development you have. And when you know your resources, you know where you can pull from.
Yeah.
And you also then are adapted with the data, understanding where your strengths are, where your areas for development are, of how to leverage yourself and learn and strengthen and endure more and more and more so that you can start leaning in rather than kind of leaning away.
What do you mean by leaning in?
Leaning in means this is challenging right now, but I'm going to continue to be challenging because that's where life is. Life isn't in the escape. If we're all looking for the end, we're all looking for the day we die, mm-hmm. right? I love the quote is live your dash, right? The day you were born on your tombstone, the day you die. Live your dash is in the moment, is in the middle, everything in between.
Right.
If we're always looking for when's the end of the race, right? If we're always looking for when does this game end? When does this pain end?
See, now this is a very interesting philosophy that you bring up, and I know that you're passionate about it, but yeah. I think... because of your psychological training, mm-hmm. because of the cumulative effect in your very young life, mm-hmm. of everything that you've done, you've put yourself in a position to have a much better understanding of live your dash.
Right.
And what you say that. So I just kind of want you to take a step back and really try to explain to the layman what you think that's about.
I was showing you a picture of my nephew, and he was in an Air Jordan like sweatshirt and sweatpants.
The little guy, yeah.
And then you kind of recall the time with your son, and your wife kind of got him a similar like zip up Air Jordan sweatshirt. Speaking about Michael Jordan effect.
Don't forget about the hood.
Yeah, and with the hoodie, right? And you talking about that moment makes me think about like living your dash is about recognizing that moment in that moment.
Yes.
Is like these moments are fleeting. These moments are going. I might not always be an able-bodied person. I might not always be as strong as I am. I might not always have the things in front of me, right? We may never have the opportunity to be with our family as much as we did if you were living at home with your parents. You may never even get to be as close to them. And of course, that creates its own struggles. But that doesn't mean that there aren't opportunities to grow and learn and connect. And I think living your dash is being in that moment, right? Really cherishing the good times in the good times.
Right. Which then is a nice segue to this notion of mindfulness.
Yes.
Right? And traditionally, as we have defined on the show for a long time, and it's appropriate to briefly revisit it, mindfulness is operationally defined as paying attention in the moment, mm-hmm. on purpose, without judgment. Right?
Yeah.
But as we've continued to evolve and we've become more laser focused, mm-hmm. and we really, through our own research for MIT, mm-hmm. encapsulated a clearer vision, a stronger mission and philosophy of who we are.
Right.
We're now starting to present ourselves in what we affectionately refer to as mindfulness 2.0.
Yep.
What's that?
Mindfulness 2.0 is not just looking at in the moment, paying attention.
On purpose.
On purpose, right? Non-judgmentally. I think all of that range true, right? We're still pulling from those, the foundation, right? We like to say we stand on the shoulders of giants, I believe. That might have been Edison. That might have been Franklin. But I know a famous inventor.
One of the biggies.
Did one say that, right? I stand on the shoulders of giants. And there are giants within the field, and they have established a great groundwork. But now it's time for that evolution, that next step of understanding. It's no longer I need to escape to be mindful. It's can I be mindful in the most challenging of situations? Can I challenge myself to be mindful when I'm not supposed to be, right? When I am overwhelmed. And mindfulness 2.0 is giving you the tools, understanding it through visualization, through data, to understand yourself a little bit more innately, right? Intimately, right? Looking kind of behind the curtain. Right, there's a lot of things that we can see from a subjective perspective, but through data, you can kind of see it a little bit more objectively.
Right. I see mindfulness 2.0 as we're talking as really a reframing mm-hmm. of the mindful moment.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is to pay attention on purpose, without judgment, in the moment. All of those things that are driving us to what's happening now.
Hmm.
What's happening now? What's happening now? Forget about the past. Don't concern yourself with the future.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening right now? This is a moment,
mm-hmm.
which is very, very true. But I think mindfulness 2.0 is really about, what are you nodding your head on?
I think I'm
what
going,
are you thinking?
Just my mind, I think, is very similar in terms of this thinking, but I want you to finish before I jump into
Go right ahead. Jump.
I think you're talking about like not just mindfulness being in the moment, but mindfulness being everywhere.
Yes.
Right. All time. It is all time. Right.
Right.
And it's not about looking at the past as something to ignore or the future to be afraid of. It's to recognize that mindfulness is what you're learning from the past, right? Not being afraid of it. Mindfulness is about looking to the future and yes. identifying that change is inevitable
yes.
and how you can adapt. And the present moment is now what you're doing actively to set yourself up for that, to help yourself learn from the past and set yourself up.
Because that phrase of in the moment, I think, encourages people too often to halt the application of said skill
right.
in past or future type moments.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I've done a lot of reading and prior to MindFlex LLC, I worked in a smaller group practice that specialized in attention deficit.
Right.
And we would recommend readings. Mm. And there was always a phrase that I remember was in the literature that we would try to educate parents regarding their children who had some type of attention deficit disorder. And it was, the mind is built, it's wired to wander.
Mm.
The mind is built, wired to wander. It's very accurate.
Right.
Because that can't be denied. And truth be told, I think that's the big knock on mindfulness of people who don't either get it, haven't really educated themselves about it, or they're quick to be like, because they label mindfulness into meditation.
Right.
Yes, there are mindful meditation practices. It's not the same as being mindful,
right.
just for the record. There is a difference. But they quickly discard the notion.
Mm-hmm.
And they remove themselves from it. Kind of like what we've talked about in past episodes of that specialized athlete that's just so damn good
right.
that's just what they have.
Mm-hmm.
I can't possibly relate to that. So we put them in that specialized category. I think mindfulness in a large part has become part of that narrative. Yeah,
right.
yeah, that's for people that can meditate.
Mm-hmm.
Those are for the yoga-driven people.
It's not for me.
It's not for me.
I can't do that.
I can't do that.
Right.
Right. And that's what it's in the moment, I think, so often is incredibly threatening.
I hate that word can't, by the way.
Why do you hate the whole can't?
It's just such a an out, right? It's just a cop-out of just saying, I can't do that. It just is such a an unwillingness to attempt, to try, to put a limitation on yourself. It just diminishes your ability.
It's a passive acceptance.
Yeah.
You know, it really is. And I say passive because it's almost as if you're letting it envelop you.
Yeah.
The moment. But again, back to the 2.0 of being mindful of a particular moment, there's great value in that. But I think through awareness that is more purposeful, that mm-hmm. is more intentional, that has information, real tangible information to suggest
right.
this is how you can vary and shift your world of perception mm-hmm. from the value of trying to get calm because I'm overwhelmed to put my gaze on something that is very important to me and shift that attention to then fire my mind and my muscles simultaneously because that makes me more in sync. Mm. There is more purpose to what we are calling mindfulness 2.0, which is really chaos in the lab.
Yep.
As you're bringing that full circle mind-body connection, it allows the person to say, yes, I am aware. Yes, I am present, but I am considering all things.
Yes.
Right? It's just more all encapsulating.
Yep.
And I think in our own little world, because we've made it very clear, the difference between mental skills and mental strength is you are training.
Right.
We are not assigning,
mm-hmm.
okay? We're not teaching. That's more traditional mental skills.
Right.
Mental strength training is training.
Right.
It's just that. It's you're coming to work out your mind.
Yep.
You're going to work up a mental sweat,
yep.
right?
Physical, yeah, and the physical sweat too. I've had multiple clients say, wow, I actually like started right. to sweat when I was doing that. I was like, yes. That's exactly it. You yeah. are you burn calories while you're also your brain is an energy source. It's using power if you think about it. So it's utilizing calories. And I'm not going to say you're going to lose a ton of weight doing it, but right, you will gain a physical. You are straining yourself, right, to the point of challenge, to the point of I'm getting a workout, a mental workout, right, which builds the cognitive endurance, which builds the mental strength. You have to think about it as you're going to the gym just as much as, no, I'm not just going to go and be quiet and calm and serene. And that's great. And there's benefits to that. There's recovery aspects to it.
Yeah, there's a place for that for sure. But
the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. You have to look at the whole totality of it, which is training, which is challenge, which is duress, which allows you to be as strong as you are. No challenge is worth it. Not necessarily true, but if Mount Everest was 100 feet tall, nobody would say I've climbed Mount Everest. It's because it's challenging, because it's 25,000 feet, because you have to spend multiple months planning, if not years planning. That's why it's so daunting and challenging, and you can die. But then there's the worth it aspect to it. That comes with it. It's the challenge.
Do you think people have the ability to scale Everest moments in their life to see what I mean by that is more challenges in their life? That's obviously not literally climbing Everest,
yeah.
which again is one of those things where they might dictate, or should I say deem to themselves, that doesn't apply to me. That's right. not something that I would ever do. I can't do that.
Well, I think a lot of people too look to Everest as I can't do Everest. Because they're looking as Everest is the first thing that they're going to start with, rather than recognize, well, you need to climb a few other things before you get up to Everest. And I think people aren't always willing to do that as well.
Why do you think that is?
People like gratification. People like that sense of accomplishment. They like the sense of grandeur as well, in terms of I've accomplished something large, or I can do something really fast. I believe in myself, or I'm a failure. It's an all or nothing thinking.
Yeah.
I'm all in or I'm all out, versus kind of working themselves up to things that are larger, that are challenging.
Do you think that there's something in history that past generations has taught us regarding that notion of the willingness to try and then fail? We've often talked about the role or the preconceived notion mm-hmm. of what failure is, what it provides. You've heard me say on past shows that the most successful people fail the most often mm-hmm. because they're stretching themselves, because they're trying new things. It's really in those moments where people are not seeing failure in a traditional capacity at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, nobody sees failure, right? And what I mean by that is...
What do you mean?
Sorry. Nobody sees successful people fail. or right. the amount of times they yes. failed.
Yeah.
Right. It's, I just see them at the top of the mountain.
Right.
It doesn't show the hours, months, years of work that they've put in to get to that successful place.
Yeah.
It's, I see them successful. Oh, I got this. I can do that. And then you spend your 3 weeks on your New Year's resolution. And then it's like, wait a minute, this is hard.
Right. So again, but I think you bring up a very good point. When people aren't seeing others fail, that's almost putting them at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. But why is it that we clamor to them once so successful and then choose to only see their success without really considering any path that it took them to get there? Because I think that's a big hurdle just as human beings.
Yeah. And I'm not really 100% sure why people are really drawn to that. I think my thoughts around it are, when you see someone successful, you want to relate, you want to connect, you want to be in that position. And I think the discrediting, or not even, I think it's more so you don't think about the failures or the challenges that kind of that come with it as well. You just see, what's that mountain? Ooh, it'd be nice to be up there. And so I don't think it's really people giving it the consistent time and effort to be overall understanding, right?
So you think it's a lack of patience?
Patience is definitely one element of it. I like to say our ego is a box within us, inside a box, inside a box, and then that's where our ego sits. And when our ego is disrupted or shaken in some capacity, we then lash out. We start to think, oh, I am a failure. We think about, I'm angry, so I have to kind of push against. And I think when you look that you're not capable of something right away, mm-hmm. that ego gets hit. That internal drive of, oh, I should have, I thought I could do this, and now I can't. Your mental script is disrupted.
Yeah.
And that dysregulates you.
And when you're not
tolerant of that.
When your script gets disrupted, why are you not tolerant of that? Why is there, help me understand why there is such a dominant pushback where as I come into my fifth decade of mm-hmm. life, right? Mm-hmm. There's a greater appreciation of what the world can teach me mm-hmm. because I know I have more in my rearview mirror than I do ahead of me. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to live to 100 years old. Mm-hmm. That's
science
that's,
is getting pretty good. We'll see.
We'll see. That's a fair certainty for me, right? But I certainly know that perhaps most definitely my physical, let's hope my not so much my cognitive faculties do not treat me as well on the back half of 50 as the first 50 did.
Right.
For that reason, that provides me with a sense of humility. Mm-hmm. It allows me to slow down and see moments for what they are. That makes me more patient mm-hmm. comprehensively. But when you look at the younger individual
right.
and what's been exposed to them mm-hmm. and the saturation of mass media at their fingertips, something is happening. I could make the argument because they've been baptized earlier by chaos in their life
right.
that perhaps they even have a misperception of what real life is.
I like to defend the generations, and I think this has happened always, right? They always say, like, the youth is wasted on the young. And I think that level of patience is recognizing that you do have more life in front of you than behind you. And I think that's important too. Like, you're rushing, but like, you could spend a decade building all the skills you need to then conquer the next 60, 70 years of your life. But people look to try to get where they would in the next 70 years in a year. And I think there's a mentality of like, people aren't building the skills necessary, the strengths necessary to then accomplish what they really are perceiving or they want, right? They're looking for what's that magic pill?
So how do we right? break
what's,
through
what's
that?
The 15 minute abs?
Right.
What's the
eight. I only need eight.
Okay. Yeah. Right. What's that fast?
So solution? How do we break through that? I think you bring up an excellent point.
Right.
How do we break through that? What's the message?
Well, I definitely think like starting young is a great kind of mentality to train. I was listening to a radio show today talking about Carter Hart, the goaltender who's only 20 years old for Flyers. The Flyers.
He's only 20.
Yeah, he's been working with a sports psychologist since he was 11 years old, and he actually like drinks a water, a bottle of water, and he watches the water fall to the ground to train his eyes to be more accurate, which is interesting. But starting at a young age, he's now kind of more adaptive to understanding, right, the psychological nature, the challenges, the mental thoughts to kind of be aligned completely, as long as the physical skills that he has.
Yeah.
But so starting young, I think, is always important. And I think the message really is to understand, to perceive the what you think you need, right? Typically, what you think you need isn't what you need. I think it tends to be something else.
Does that require a certain level of maturity or flexibility? One, to be open to discussion, and then two, to receive perhaps what you need that does not align with what you think?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's disruption. It all comes down to disruption, right? Is when is something, like, when are the things that in your life that you learn the most, is some of the most disruptive moments within your
life?
Some
of the most upsetting, some of the most tumultuous.
Right. And they can be the most joyous too.
It can. But there's something about, you know, the concept of flashbulb memory, like right. a 9/11 moment
yep.
that is so significantly charged emotionally mm-hmm. that your brain really has no choice but to snapshot it mm-hmm. and put it somewhere. I think stereotypically people assume they gravitate to the negative
right.
when they think about that emotional charge moment that leaves that footprint that's enduring.
Right. So again, in embracing, I guess, chaos of the world and in that lead up to where you want to be, it's about understanding disruption is going to happen. Failure is inevitable. And I don't mean failure in terms of, again, I like to still deem failure as failure only occurs when you stop trying, right? If you're willing to continue to try, failure isn't occurring. It's just a learning opportunity.
Sure. And really the notion of failure doesn't even come into the conversation.
Right.
Because it's ongoing.
Yep.
Right.
You're always, if you're 0 years old and you're 99 years old, you're still growing, you're still developing in some capacity because you're experiencing the world.
Right.
Right. It's the first time you've experienced something in that way. Right. Even if you experienced that same thing in the same place at the same time, it's a different day. It's a different you. Right. You're experiencing it differently in some capacity. So you're always growing. You're always developing. And I think it's important to understand that as a person. Some really good advice that I heard was the 20s is really your time to explore yourself and build your connections. Your 30s are there to really hone the skills, and your 40s are there to now like establish your career.
Mm-hmm.
Right, where it used to be when you're 14 years old, you're going to work in this factory, and then you're 95 years old, and now you can retire.
Yeah.
So the world is different, definitely.
The world is most certainly different, but again, as we continue to push through this notion of 2020 being a very chaotic year, it's really allowed us to have such a defining. Typically in history, moments, and I can't speak to enduring a world war, but I guess in my framework, that would probably be the next closest event that had a chronic impact. When you think about, I was talking to you a couple of weeks ago about the Netflix show Outlander.
Yep.
Of the story of a husband and wife that are separated during World War II for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You think about that for 5 years,
yeah.
5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he was more of a traditional military man at an administrative level, and she was the equivalent of a field ER nurse.
Mm.
So they had very uniquely different perspectives, but married. And at the beginning of the show gives you some of that history to set you up for a long weekend where they're going to reconnect because the war is over.
Mm-hmm.
So here it is. There's this married couple
right.
that's been apart for 5 years that's going away for a romantic getaway because they don't really know each other anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So you think about that for a second of how that, by no choice of their own, of when they were born,
right.
that historical event of World War II mm-hmm. completely changed the identity of the relationship, arguably of the individuals that were participating in it.
Yes, absolutely.
So here we are in 2020. We have not endured a world war of such magnitude,
mm-hmm.
of such loss, of such devastation.
Mm-hmm.
But we're now in almost mid-January 2021, starting to talk about the year-long anniversary of COVID-19 being among us. Mm-hmm. And I personally cannot believe that it's almost been a year.
Right.
Maybe that goes back to my athletic mentality of putting my head down and just getting back after it in the weight room and waiting until the next season.
Right.
Or waiting till the next opportunity for me to rise my head up and say, okay, the smoke is cleared.
Right.
Right. So what is it about what we've endured over the course of this chaotic time mm-hmm. that has sculpted us so much so, Hunter, that we can now sit down with your traditional athletes? We're having some collegiate athletes that are starting to return to us mm-hmm. that came and visited and worked with you over break. Mm-hmm. What message can we share with them based on that chronic time block of their life? As to, yeah, we're giving you a snapshot of chaos in our lab, but this is the bigger picture. What bigger picture do you think that you can help them with?
Well, you can't predict anything that's going to happen to you, right? Your experience, right? You're trying to put yourself into a position. Nobody expects, nobody was predicting. Nobody's really putting what occurred during 2020 on their calendar on January 1st, 2020. It's chaos is inevitable. Right, chaos is coming, and it's how do I adapt and utilize my resources and find solutions as a part of that. And so that's what we try to impart on them in the larger picture, right? Is performance, we look for performance, we're training for performance, we're strength training for performance, we're endurance training for performance, but really what we're doing is we're trying to establish them and help them deal with and manage the challenges of life. Because life isn't just athletics, life isn't just family, life isn't just social, it's everything in between, right? It's the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, right? Understanding that you are not just one moment in your life, right? As you deem failure, success, you are not just that one moment. There is a much more, there's a totality to come with it. We are not just 2020, we are not just COVID-19. It's just a moment that has occurred in our history. It's something that we're going to look back on. It's definitely shaped us, but it's not something that's going to, it has changed, but doesn't have to derail, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. Yeah. And, you know, through the course of this discussion, and I'm just, you know, enjoying some of your explanations and how you, through your own journey, through mm-hmm. your own course of development, have started to crystallize your own set of rules, so mm-hmm. to speak, and it's nice to hear you share them. It's something that I've been invested in, obviously, mm-hmm. through the course of our work together, but also too, I think for me, the silver lining of 2020 and this phantom opera of control that we've all been forced to sit down and watch. Mm-hmm. has completely been redefined for me.
Right.
And what I mean by that is being a business owner of a decade and creating something from nothing, you quickly, one of my favorite quotes is the man of true character falls back upon himself and faced with adversity. When faced with adversity, the man of true character falls back upon himself. Mm-hmm. I identified with that. I don't know who said it. I forget. Around my time in high school. Mm-hmm. And I've always been that person who tried to lead by that example.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why I said earlier when COVID hit, I went back to my athletic roots, mm-hmm. my athletic background. Yeah. This is a challenge.
Yes.
It's riddled with adversity. Mm-hmm. I just have me. Mm-hmm. But that didn't apply in this case.
Right.
Because I had to figure out very quickly how to transition a practice from completely in person to fully virtual. Mm-hmm. I had to manage and negotiate relationships through my affiliation with a host of universities mm-hmm. and their students. I had to change everything about who I was that I had very purposefully worked on for a decade. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like it at all. And my first notion was no.
Mm-hmm.
No. This, no.
Right.
This does not, no. This does not apply to me.
Right.
And very quickly, my definition of control left the building.
Right.
And I think there's something to that when you talk about mental scripts, when you talk about the role that chaos plays. I think it's chaos skews, disrupts the notion of control.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why it's so highly personal. And I think that's why it can grab you by the throat.
Mm-hmm.
And it can have a very dramatic effect.
See, this is when you're going to want to slap me, because my opportunistic aspect is like, look at all the stuff that, yes, it was. Look at how you adapted, though, because you had to. But you had to embrace it and adapt and change. And you've learned new skills and you've learned how to manage this aspect. And if this was to occur again, it wouldn't be something that you would say ideal, but you would have some resources now in place to be able to do that and manage that more effectively. And again, it's far from ideal, but now this opportunity has, or this moment has led to you learning a whole new set of skills and mm-hmm. ability. And I think what you're feeling is 100% genuine, natural, and real. And at the same time, you still then had to put an action to adapt and change and grow. And through that, through the reflection of it, you're going to look back in this year and hopefully laugh and be like, holy crap, that was a crazy year. Like, we had to do all of this stuff. It was a time that our business almost closed, or our business did close, and how do we re-divert? And what did that look like, right? Not just for you, but for all people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's me kind of being naive, and I'm not in those situations, and I definitely feel for those people. And at the same time, it's recognizing, how do we grow? How do we learn? How as an individual, can I make changes? And then hopefully, how does that influence the changes of others?
First off, there's no slapping involved. That's strictly off camera. And I align with your opportunistic ideology
mm-hmm.
in all aspects.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, and it's not even so much a point of difference, I think it's perhaps a way of trying to articulate it. The key difference is, because you are who you are,
mm-hmm.
you're proactively looking at those moments to find the opportunity.
Right.
And I think the mass hurdle for most people
mm-hmm.
is not having that mindset.
Mm-hmm.
It makes total sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, again, driving us to, if this is the reality, if we have been saying for months now, chaos is coming,
mm-hmm.
and really that's become more metaphorical for us introducing ourselves or engaging the performance world in a new baptism
mm-hmm.
of what performance enhancement training needs to look like in 2021.
Right.
How people adjust to those in the moment scenarios is predicated on, do they see it as an opportunity to learn?
Mm-hmm.
Or is their first knee-jerk reaction one of control?
Mm-hmm.
One of, what are you doing over there, man?
He had the quote.
Oh, you had the Charles. You found the quote? Oh, there you go.
Charles
faced Duchamp. With crisis, the man of character falls back upon himself. See, I changed crisis to adversity in mm-hmm. my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Charles de Gaulle. There you go. Thank you for finding that podcast, Mike.
No problem.
So what are your thoughts over there as you kind of take all this in? Rock the mic.
I try to stay proactive with like how Hunter handles it, but at a lot of times you find yourself like get too personally invested in how it's limiting your life, and how you, like you said, you've been preparing for a decade. I get sometimes, like, for me, it's a struggle of like almost like selfishly, like I should have the right to do this, but I can't, when it comes like that, the chaos of, we want to talk about COVID or whatever it may be.
Right. The chaos of life.
The chaos of life. And
It's just a whole lot clearer with COVID.
I think it's tougher. It's something that I can work on, but it's tougher said. It's easier said than done for me.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's 100% true. I think it is almost always easier, right, said than done. It's, again, me saying these things is not saying it's easy. It is very challenging. But if you swing the other way and recognize that it's challenging and then do nothing or don't learn from it, you've failed, right? Because mm-hmm. you're not trying, you're not learning, you're not growing,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think you need to separate, people need to separate challenge and hard from doing and not doing, right? It has to be separate, right? Of how you're adapting, how you're learning. You've grown, you've done different things throughout this time as well. I'm sure every listener has had to do something differently than their normal routine. And that doesn't discredit it being hard, but it's something that you did. It's something that you wouldn't have done. And I think there's a reason for that. And you should recognize yourself and the adaptations that you had to put in place, the challenges that you faced throughout this, and really see yourselves as either remarkable as being able to do it as a person, as a country, like as a world. Like, we really had to deal with something that was challenging. So
the way I think about it is, maybe it's exactly what we needed. I know it's hard to envision that with all the tragedy and the death and everything, but
that was the sentiment that I had for the first 3 months. I think it was, you know, this is the world's wake up call. My wife would sit and we would talk. This is maybe May, June, early onset of summer, and we would typically not see each other for potentially weeks on end on the weekends, because my son would be playing travel baseball games in a tri-state area and my daughter travel softball games. And my wife and I would split and we would alternate. And sometimes it was a weekend tournament. Sometimes it was day trips. We would spend more time texting each other what inning it was, what was the score, and how well did our kids do in their respective positions. And we would talk about, we're running way too fast. Life is moving at a rapid pace. When are we going to slow down? And we would have those conversations for the first few months. If you remember, the sentiment of that was largely communicated was that people were being more mindful and reflecting of in the moment scenarios, time with their kids, the ability to work from home, not engaging in the rat race. Mm. That was the sentiment. But right around the time that the presidential election started to heat up and the madness in Minnesota ensued, everything changed, in my opinion. All the positivity was sucked out of the room. And I think we I can only speak to being an American, as a United States citizen, have been hanging on as best we can. Yes, there are moments of humanitarianism that we've seen, that we've tried to perhaps engage in ourselves personally. We read about it. We see it on TV.
But we don't see that enough. And
you're
right. That's the problem.
You're right.
The things that are highlighted, right? And I think that's where a lot of that comes from too, is the things that aren't, yeah, the things that aren't really highlighted for us. And yeah. I think the world that we are in currently, of the digital world, the space that we're in, I think glorifies and promotes, right, those, the negative, the challenges, the things that aren't going the way that we want it to go, right? Because those are the things that get the most engagement. But those moments of happiness, those moments of humanitarianism, I think the most money has ever been raised for, like America, like feast, like feeding hunger, like hungry people, like serving people to get food, right, who are out of jobs right now, that the Barstool Fund right now is created, right?
With Russell Wilson did a huge promotion.
Yeah, that's out the company.
In Seattle,
yep. Yep, yep,
for
yep.
meals.
That's what it is, yeah. Yep. And yeah, the Barstool Fund just raised over like $10 million for struggling businesses and now has been giving money to those struggling businesses.
It has brought out the best in us in so many ways. But to your point, which we could go on and on about, it seems like, it feels like the majority of mass media wants to continue to bathe in the negative connotation of societal chaos, whether it brings in viewership or sells newspapers or whatever other reason might fit the bill. It certainly feels that way. And
does one come without the other, right? And you need, you know, it does good acts of kindness, the human elements, right? Do humanitarian efforts of growth happen without like tragedy, with challenge, with people like, if you don't need to feed people, you don't need to raise money for people.
I would like to think that we don't need adversity, that we don't need crisis for those things to happen. But it certainly does feel like, again, back to the, we're not paying attention to the successful people until they're successful.
Right.
We're not really paying attention to all the good, all to the philanthropic efforts that people are engaging in until something bad happens.
Right.
Right. Is that a human nature element? Is that a byproduct of us living perhaps in a higher tide of chaos without having that mindful athlete preserver to get us to the surface?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? We could go on and on, but, I have thoroughly enjoyed listening to you today.
Yeah, you too.
And
good conversation back in 2021.
It's back in 2021. So for all of our viewers out there, again, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Head Game Podcast. My name is Dr. Lee Piccarello.
Dr. Hunter Stevens.
And we will catch you on the flip side next time. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.